Welcome to another episode of Fast Talk. What's the rest of the line, Rob?
Your source for the truth.
Wow.
Wow, was that bold. I am not standing behind that.
I was going to say, I'm about to leave.
You have to sound like a truth seeker podcast.
We speak the truth here, people.
Oh, no.
You know, hey, I realized a truth this morning.
What's your truth?
Grant and I, we're like two versions of the same person.
We are not even close.
No, because of this. Grant texts at 8:45 this morning. Guys, I'm going to be a little bit late. Because it's a late start Wednesday.
Right.
I'm also freaking out. Like, how am I going to get all this stuff done? So then Griffin, thank you, Griffin, for actually being on top of the calendar, is like, hey, our recording is at 10 o'clock in the morning. And what does Grant respond? Great. I'm going to get breakfast, which is exactly the, oh, good. Now I get a chance to eat before we record. Yep. And then what happens? You pull up in a silver SUV with a black ski box on top and you park right next to my silver SUV. Your Carhartt today, I'm Filson. Maybe there's a little difference.
There's a little yin and yang.
Same.
There's yin and yang with our fashion, but that's the whole point.
It's just, you make me laugh so much.
Griffin, I'm a little scared.
I wish I was in the room with you guys, just missing this camaraderie here.
I'm the short hair version of Grant, and Grant's the long hair version of me.
I'm down with that.
Right?
I'm down with that. Yeah. I'm okay with that. I am okay being compared to Rob Pickles.
So if anybody hasn't figured it out yet, this is another potluck episode. We're off to a good start.
It's perfect.
Perfect. Maybe Griffin's not here because I'm putting my legs up on her chair. Thanks, Griffin.
You're welcome.
And just to get everybody excited about this episode, we have picked a question that Grant has already said is going to get him killed.
I'm
going to
get in trouble. Absolutely going to get in trouble for this.
Are we talking pitchforks? What's the repercussion here?
Probably metaphorical pitchforks.
Okay.
So this is going to be fun. Everybody hang on.
I'm ready.
Alter Exploration is a new custom cycling tour company created by me, Fast Talk Labs co-founder, Chris Case. Alter Exploration crafts challenging, transformative cycling journeys in some of the world's most stunning destinations. Alter's trips aren't so much a vacation as an exploration of the destination and of yourself. At the end of every day, be preoccupied as much by the transformative experience as by the satisfaction of exhaustion. Reach a greater understanding of your physical and mental capabilities while simultaneously experiencing a jaw-dropping landscape. Life. Altered. Learn more about my favorite adventure destinations and start dreaming at alterexploration.com.
Griffin, we're going to start with your question. So what do you have for us?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this and heading into the potluck about athletes and some of the interviews that we've had in the last few months with some of these professional athletes and their journey. And when they decided to say, you know, it's time that I work with a coach. And I think that point is different for each athlete and also based on their experience. And now because of social media, you could follow anyone and just get little clips of free workouts here and there, and you can piecemeal together potentially a training plan, or you can listen to little motivational clips here and there that might keep you going after a hard day. But when we think about it, I really wanted to put this question to the three of you. What is an athlete missing out on when they're not saying, okay, it's time for a coach? What are they missing out on by not having a coach to work with, to rely on, to have that one point of contact whose responsibility it is to support them in this capacity?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. And for me, an objectiveness to training is one of the first things that come up. I think oftentimes as an athlete, there's an emotional response to the things that you want to do, the training that you want to do. And it might not be rooted in the most logical decision making. The other thing that I tend, and I'm just going to get my stuff out of the way because maybe you two are going to have a deeper discussion. The other things that I tend to see are, as an athlete who is not immersed in the information all the time, it can be very confusing because you hear so much information. Oftentimes it's conflicting with each other. And I think that coaches have a better grasp on that. And then lastly, that's it. I only have two.
Well, since Rob started this by saying we are the source of truth, which is a new thing, we're going to have to adjust this podcast.
We're omnipotent at this point.
Oh my gosh.
Does this mean that we're going to start getting into conspiracy theories?
No.
That could be fun.
How is the ego fitting in that small room right now?
There's extra room with you doing this remote. So.
Rob is kind of crowding us all out. His head's getting big. Yeah. So here's my honest, unfiltered answer. You are losing reality checks.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one of the greatest values of coaches, because we think we have all this data, we have all this information, and that allows us to coach ourselves. But there's one thing I've learned about data is you can make it say what you want it to say. And you can fool yourself, or you can put a huge focus on getting the right data and actually do the wrong training. And a coach is the person that sits there and goes, you aren't where you think you are, or you are putting the focus in the wrong area. And without that coach, it's really easy to go down that road. And I haven't coached myself for years. Thank you.
Mixed levels of success. Yeah, that's where he was going.
That's where I was going.
That's the exact opposite point.
I'll say it.
That's exactly the point. And I can tell you, I have gone down that trap myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm even aware of it sometimes that I'm going, I'm completely deluding myself here. And right now I'm kind of okay with that. And you need that coach to go, no, stop that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree with that. I did that to myself last year, wholeheartedly. We got back from the World Cup and I put all my cyclocross athletes on a break, gave them like 3-4 days off the bike. And I took 2 days off the bike and said, well, now I'm going to train. I'm going to train, which was just idiotic. And it almost buried the whole second half of my season. I think the biggest thing for me, the thing that screamed in my head when you asked this question, Griffin, was peace of mind. It's a very broad statement, right? But as you guys both mentioned, the objectivity that a coach brings allows you to just kind of, all right, I don't have to try to figure out where I am. I don't have to try to figure out if this video I watched on YouTube is right or wrong. I don't have to figure out what I read online is correct or incorrect. I can question my coach. You should question your coach. You should ask for more information. You should push them on things. But the whole point in having a coach is having somebody that you can trust, having somebody you can lay into, and then you can shut your brain down to some of those things so that you can focus on A, your training, B, your life in a different order.
Yeah.
A, your life, B, your training.
Yeah. I think the other thing too is that the benefit that each athlete derives from a coach is different mm-hmm. based on that coach-athlete mm-hmm. combination.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And when I work with athletes, it's almost completely different for every athlete that I work with. There are some athletes I sit down and I actually write training with them together. Yeah. We work through it. There are other athletes where it's a little bit more of a one-way street from flowing from me to them. There are some athletes I don't really even write training for. I just check and balance the stuff that they're already doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people need to know that this coach-athlete relationship can be whatever works best for them. It doesn't have to fit into one mold. So the benefit you derive is really personal.
Well, I'm going to jump in because I think that's incredibly important. And I think it's really important for people to realize that coaching can take on many of these various personas, right? You can hire somebody to just look over your shoulder and make sure what you're doing is not crazy. That will offer peace of mind. You can ask somebody to come in and write the training and drive the direction, which also offers peace of mind. Interestingly enough, that's really something that a lot of people who have huge control in other aspects of their life mm-hmm. want to give up the control in that aspect of their life because they don't have the time or the energy to think about it.
Yep.
Or it can be true, and I always think it needs to be collaborative, but it can be very, very collaborative. I'm at the point with a couple of my athletes that I've been with for 5 or 6 years where we exactly do that, Rob. We sit down and we write training together. Yep. Or they're going to come to the table and go, I don't like that. Let's do something different.
Yep.
And look, I'm going to flip this around. We're right now talking about what do you lose if you opt out of coaching. We're assuming it's a good coach.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'm going to flip it around and say there are bad coaches out there. And I've seen athletes work with coaches where it's hard to say this to the athlete. I'm never going to badmouth somebody, but it's you just look at the training plan and go, you would be better off just going out and riding or running every day with zero plan than following this plan.
Well, and I think even, you know, taking that to the other level, you'll tend to look at things the way you look at things. And I'll look at it and go, you would be better off doing anything.
But I give the truth.
Not having this relationship.
You only give the truth some of the time. You're not here all the time.
That's true. That's true. I always
give the truth.
I'm partial truth. but to your point, right, you can look at a training plan and go, that training plan is not beneficial. But you can look at the relationship and go, that relationship is damaging. I think that, you know, we have to have this understanding of what it is that our needs are, right? What are our basic needs as an athlete and as a person? And we need to make sure that people in our lives are meeting those needs. And a coach is a really, I hate to say it, but it's a fairly simple way to start or to correct. You know, if you're not getting your needs from your spouse, that's a longer discussion. That's going to take a lot more. Not getting your needs from your coach. If they're not open to hearing that, hey, switch coaches. Mm-hmm. And B, if they are open to hearing that, have that conversation and get what you need, because it can do so much for so many aspects of your life.
If I may, what are the fallacies you see in athletes today who think they can do it on their own, especially because of social media and what's available to them for free?
I'll start with this because one of the first things I see is people that majored in exercise phys. Well, I have a degree in this. I can coach myself. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying. I mean, no offense, but like when you combine that bit of knowledge, which is likely outdated.
It's not enough. Yeah.
And you combine that little bit of knowledge with the hubris that goes along with saying, I have this knowledge. You have enough knowledge to get yourself in a hell of a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm.
So I'll take that a step further and say one of my biggest approaches to life is I'm a gestaltist. And summary of that is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So you can't just take all these different pieces, add them together, and then say you've got something great. You have to look at the whole as a whole. And until you look at it that way, you're just looking at the parts and you can go in the wrong direction. Sorry, I know I'm not explaining this very well. But what I'm getting at is you do have a lot of athletes that go, well, I've read all these articles. I've learned what TSS is. I've learned what the various types of intervals are. You learn all these different things. You learn some of the physiology. And then you go, okay, I've got all the pieces, so I can now put this together. And often it gets put together wrong. And it's not an insult to the person. You've learned all the pieces. But what you see in a great coach is they have these underlying principles in which they frame all these pieces that allows all of them to fit together and work well together. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest mistakes I see athletes make is they'll read these studies and go, hey, I'm reading all the research and this workout produces a 2% increase in first, and this workout produces a 4% increase, and this workout produces a 3.5% increase. So if I do all these workouts, I'm going to improve like 10% and kill everybody. No, you're just going to burn out.
Yeah.
No. The other thing too, Trevor, I think building off what you're saying is in the self-coaching individual, I often see people being a little bit, I don't know, sporadic.
Yeah, they're
jumping
all over the
between
place.
Training methods and training takes time and you have to have the confidence to continue down the path that you're on to eventually realize the benefits of that. And some people will go a month doing this and then a month doing that and they're all over the place. Each one of those might have worked and been beneficial, but they're not because you didn't let that soak in.
Well, one of the big pieces on that topic is that the vast majority of us are really, really bad at self-evaluation. We're terrible at it.
Speak for yourself.
Well, you may be one of those that's just that enlightened.
I like that. That's a good term for me.
Or just self-critical. Yeah.
No, we're going to go with enlightened for the next 5 minutes. Yeah. But it's really, really hard to look at yourself and not be too critical if you're going to criticize. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people tend to not be critical. They don't go down that road because they know how they're going to beat themselves up. And so that leads to that jumping around, right? This isn't working. I need to try something else. This isn't working. I need to try something else. And we need to have that patience. We need to have that trust. And we need to have that relationship back and forth so that we can question the trust and the patience and be okay with it in the end. Mm-hmm.
So this weekend, I did my first winter fatigue block in a couple of years.
Okay.
And first of all, embarrassing that what used to be a typical training week is now my fatigue block.
I did a fatigue block too. I went skiing for 3 days and I'm wrecked right now.
Yep. I get that.
All right, well, brag about it. Okay.
I was on the bike and I suffered, but I did Neil's 40P test.
Oh, okay.
And was trying to convince myself my numbers are not as bad as they are. So you should have seen all the things I convinced myself of. First of all, didn't even put the effort into the 5 minutes. And I'm like, yep, no, I know I could do 60 watts higher than this.
Did you do it indoor?
I did it indoor.
Oh, 15% higher outdoor then. You
there
can add
there
that
you
up.
Go. Yeah, and when I got to the 20-minute test, I was like 10 minutes in, trying to suffer through the wattage I used to be able to do. And I'm like, oh, I could probably hold this another 10 minutes. I don't need to prove it.
Oh, Jesus.
And the whole time going, I am an idiot. I'm just so trying to fool myself here.
I love it.
Your first problem was choosing personally to do the 40P test. Like just making that decision yourself. That has to be prescribed by somebody else. The self-loathing that is required to do that to yourself, I don't see how. Yeah.
It was some good self-loathing.
I think the only person that really would do it to themselves over and over and over again is Neil. That's part of why he came up with it. He loves to do that to himself.
Yeah, well, I did about the most half-assed 4DP test you've ever seen. And when I, a couple days ago, looked at my data to say, what are my numbers? I'm like, I don't have any more clarity than I had before I did this test.
Fair.
I at least had the wherewithal to say that.
You got something there, right? The mental calisthenics required for justification of those things is...
Yeah, it's a lot easier to just not even do any testing and just assume an FTP.
Yeah, well...
Because then you're not lying to yourself.
But, okay, in all seriousness, you know what your FTP is. You don't need a test to know what your FTP is.
Yes, I do. And I was trying to do the test to prove that what I know my FTP is isn't my FTP. That's what this was about.
Right. I totally understand that. Fair enough.
Well, right. Griffin, anything else we want to dive into in this question?
Did your question get answered, Griffin?
Yeah.
I think it did. I think you had talked about the sum being greater than the parts earlier, Trevor. And I think that kind of answers to me one of the biggest points of modern dilemma that the younger athlete may face because of all the resources available that they could piece together is, yeah, essentially you can piece these things together, but you're not going to have, you know, to Grant's point, the ability to self-diagnose or look at the bigger picture and pull everything together or have that objective third party that's going to keep you consistent rather than just constantly switching plans or protocols or something else. So I do think we answered that question.
Good.
Good job, everybody.
Well, let's get to the spicy one. Let's get to the truth, Rob. What's your question?
Runners, am I right?
Yes, you're right.
You know, here's a phenomenon that we have with
runners. Isn't your wife a runner?
She is.
Oh.
Where do you think this question came from?
Tread carefully.
This question is a legitimate argument that we've had in the past 6 months.
Before you even ask the question, I'm just going to go, I don't coach runners, which isn't true, but I'm just going to bag out of this question. So you two
are the
ones who get into trouble.
I know. Running is hard, not just because I'm a cyclist, but because when we're talking about cycling, oftentimes we're doing workloads and things like wattage. And wattage is ultimately pretty universal, right? It doesn't matter how fast you're going. It doesn't matter how steep the hill is. Maybe it matters how steep the hill is. We can have that argument. But runners oftentimes, because they're such a traditional group, rely on things like, I don't know, pace to do all of their workload quantification. And here in Boulder, we have this really interesting phenomenon where when you're going west, the road, no matter what, slopes upward at like 1 to 1.5%. And when you're going east, it's the opposite. Yet, a runner, like my wife, will go out and just run 7-minute miles.
No matter what.
No matter what.
No matter what.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Or she'll do a workout and she'll be like, oh my God, that workout like kicked my butt. Like it really shouldn't have been that hard. And then I go back and I look on Training Peaks. It's like you did all your intervals going uphill, also into the wind.
Into
because
the
wind comes from the west.
Yep.
And then usually it's on a dirt road north of town. So we're going uphill into the wind on a dirt road. And that's exactly the same as if she's doing laps on the track.
But Rob.
Amazing.
I was running at a pace.
Exactly. It's all about that pace.
Pace is equivalent to effort, is it not?
In some regard, but not exactly. And this is the point of my spiel. And maybe there's nothing to take home from this. It's this. Runners don't rely on pace. It doesn't necessarily quantify the external workload that you're doing. And so my question, if there is a question in here, is... how do we better quantify the workload of a runner?
Well, here's the thing. I don't even think we should answer this question. I think we should just bag on runners.
Oh, okay. We can do that.
For 20 minutes.
I know. God.
We're all about the truth.
Oh, my gosh.
Runners.
What do you mean? Oh, my gosh, Griffin. There is no sport. There's no sport out there that requires more self-destruction. Then
self-loathing.
Self-loathing. Yeah. Like, why would you run for that long unless you hate? I actually, that's not true. I'm kidding.
I'm not. I love
really
runners.
I really got into running this fall.
I'm married to a runner. I run myself at times. I think I broke my foot like a week ago running.
Here's my one bagging on running, because you know my soapbox is people underdress. There is nobody who is worse at underdressing than runners.
That's true.
Dude, just wear a pair of gloves.
Are we talking because of the short shorts?
The short shorts when it's like 10 degrees out.
No. They wear a short shorts, a t-shirt, and gloves. And you're totally fine.
And you're fine.
I kid you not. I was snowshoeing in the mountains 2 years ago. I'm over by the Flatirons going up one of the trails. The snow is like a foot and a half deep. I'm like looking like somebody from the Arctic, completely bundled up, face covered, everything, got snowshoes on.
And he's Canadian.
And I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
And coming down the trail is a guy in shorts and no shirt.
Oh, that's because it was Anton Kripika.
Yeah, you even knew it the second I told you the story.
I mean, I would expect no less.
And you don't know how hard it was for me to resist as he passed me, just saying, dude, you're a moron.
You should have said it. I would have loved to see what his reaction would be.
I think you should have said, dude, you're a monster, but whatever.
I don't think it's all about self-loathing, though. You know, like, I definitely don't run consistently at a long distance. And I actually do the thing where a few times a year I put my shoes on and I'll go out and I'll run 13 miles out of nowhere. And I wasn't even running 2 miles consistently before that. So I'm not necessarily smart, but there's something about being able to push yourself in that capacity. I don't know why, but running does it, I think, more than having to use a bike or other equipment. Just there's something about that. It's immediately accessible, whereas, you know, water, swimming isn't. So
all those things are true, but this is exactly to my point. Like, here's this thing you can do on a bike. It's amazing. And you still travel forward. It's called coasting. And you can't do that when you run. Like, running is by nature, and all joking aside, it's very, very hard. You don't get a break. You don't get to rest. You don't really get to recover.
What if you ran in Heelys? Just broke your logic there, buddy.
Yeah, that would be pretty sweet. I need a little rest.
Oh my gosh.
But I will say that in all seriousness, running requires an understanding of your body to do it well that isn't really required in other things, because in swimming, we stop when we do intervals, and cycling, we coast. Those things really aren't available that much in running. But that is part of the problem with running too, in the same breath. It's very, very hard to get runners to slow down or to stop or to walk on their recoveries, on their track sessions. It's very, very hard to get runners to slow down. And this is, to me, the crux of the problem with running. And it's very true in other sports too. It's very true in cycling. It's very true in swimming. When we start talking about what's unquantifiable in running, the same issues are true in swimming. You can't really quantify anything in swimming other than pace.
Yep.
So you run into something where you go, I have two metrics. I have my heart rate, I have my pace. Unfortunately, I think athletes, we see everything come full circle, but I think we've poo-pooed heart rate so hard over the last 20 years that we've actually pulled it out of its role in determining our zone. To be completely honest, like, we use wattage over heart rate now, and I understand the benefits of doing that. But remember that if you're trying to get into a sub-threshold zone, you're talking about total body function. You're not talking about pedal power. You're talking about respiration rate. You're talking about heart rate. You're talking about all these other things that we can't necessarily measure or can't rely on all the time. So we rely on watts. We don't have that in running. I remember when Stride came out. And everybody's like, oh, this is great. We're going to be able to measure wattage in running. All Stride really is able to tell us is efficiency of running. If you're putting out more watts, you're being inefficient. Not necessarily I'm going harder. I know there's caveats to that. And don't take, I am not trying to be the harbinger of truth, as Rob would say. But to me, what drives me crazy with coaching runners or triathletes is that they are so married to the black and white. They are so married to the pace as a measuring stick of where they are good or where they are bad. And they have a lot of trouble letting go of that. And they love to compare themselves with other people. The most idiotic workout that any runner ever does is the Sunday long run in a group. It's moronic. It's supposed to be supposed to be a long aerobic run, and people are out there hoofing it at 5:30s claiming they're going aerobic. They're not going aerobic. They're beating the snot out of one another.
Yeah.
And we don't ever do that in bike rides and group rides.
No, we do that all the time in group rides, which is why I hate group rides.
But I also will say, though, it is easier for a cyclist to hide.
You can sit in. You can sit in.
And be at base if you're not taking pulls on the front, even though you're going faster. Yeah, Grant, it's really interesting that, you know, heart rate is not a common metric in runners, right? And heart rate is an amazing measure of the sort of the internal workload versus the external over ground. And, You know, I know for me, when I'm writing workouts for runners, and I do this so much more than I do it with cyclists, I really focus on what it should be feeling
right.
like.
Absolutely.
Right. This is what you should be experiencing during this interval, as opposed, and I also will give a pace or whatever as well, but I want that checks and balances. I want that system, because I think that the runner is oftentimes a little bit more in tune to RPE than the cyclist is.
They have to be.
Exactly. You know, and so for me, I don't know that it's another metric like, say, normalized graded pace. Right. I think normalized graded pace is maybe a bit more accurate than straight pace. If you're on something that's a little bit consistent, you know, you're running on a normal 2% incline and it's been that for 1,000 feet. I don't know that the stride running pod is the way to go. I don't like a calculation of something like that, at least with like cycling wattage, we're like actually measuring a torque, you know? And so for me, it's pace, because that is just the commonality that a runner is going to use. And to speak a language other than pace is very foreign to them. And also really describing the feeling of what they should be experiencing.
I think it's so hard, because in running, really the only thing that matters is the effort level. Right. And you have to have a clear understanding of what the effort level is. And often when I'm giving a run workout to triathletes or to runners, I'm in a place where I'm like, I want this at marathon effort, mm-hmm. not marathon pace. Mm. And they're very different things. Sure. It's even a little bit of like the difference between FTP and LT, which is, to me, blows me away that there's not a clear understanding that functional threshold power means that it's variable. Mm-hmm. It can change based on your functionality in that day. And this is something that runners have, and cyclists are bad at it too, right? But what I think is really missing the boat, this is also incredibly true in swim training, is the coaches are missing the boat in this aspect. The coaches are overtraining runners massively because there is not a very good reduction of workload as we go through this. There's rarely rest weeks. Again, very true in swimming. Swimming is hard every day. Swimming is the quintessential sport where there's no body weight load, so they just go harder.
Yeah.
And in running, there is a body weight load, and so they just go harder until they break. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, any sport where it is socially acceptable, and not just socially acceptable, but sport-wide acceptable, that you will have a stress fracture at some point is wrong. That is wrong. There's no way around the fact that that is wrong. And this is where I'm going to get passionate. And this is where I get so, so angry. You think the mental health of these athletes is not being destroyed by the fact that a coach is being told, is telling that athlete, if you don't get hurt, you're not training hard enough at some point. If you're not doing water running, you're not doing this right. And every athlete that cross trains or does something different in the running world gets vilified and gets told that they're not going to be as good as the one that's able to do the workload. This is a monumental problem. It's a monumental problem in the structure, the social structure of the sport. No. Sorry, everybody.
You said you were going to go there and you went there. Look, I think let's just shift gears slightly. I think it's important to give a little bit of history here from the science side. For a very long time, you look back 80s, 90s, all the research was on running.
Yes.
And there was a reason for that, because you need an external metric. Whenever you do an intervention study, you have your intervention, and then you need some way of measuring performance. And so that way of measuring performance, it isn't heart rate. You can't go, oh, their heart rate's better after 6 weeks of training. It's not how it works. The external metric, that thing that they can use to measure performance, is pace. Did their pace improve? Did it not improve? So we had this pace thing in running, and for decades, running was the gold standard for endurance sports research, because you had this thing that you could control and you could measure. And you look at all the research from back then, everything was based on pace, because that was their external measure. Then they invented power meters on the bike, and all of a sudden research all shifted over to the bike, saying, oh my God, this is even more controllable, even more scientific than pace, and really allows us to see the impacts and what's happening with the athletes and control the intervention. Personally, no basis behind this. Sorry, Rob, we're not necessarily the truth here. I think this is some of the impetus behind inventing power meters for running, which I can't wrap my head around.
No, it doesn't work.
I don't think it works, but I think it's we got to catch up to cycling now. We got to find something as scientific as what cycling has. So let's invent a running power meter.
Well,
sorry.
And I'm going to get on another soapbox here. And here's the problem across the board with exercise physiology. No offense to the hard science people in the room. You take a moderately trained individual as defined in science as what a moderately trained individual is, which, by the way, to everybody listening to this podcast, is essentially an untrained individual. That's how we would see the moderately trained individual. You take them and you do a whole bunch of training with them and you ask them to go faster. Of course, they're going to go faster. They spent more time doing it. Mentally, they're more prepared for it. Mentally, they're more comfort with the uncomfortable. We have to accept the fact that there's a huge psychological piece of all of this. So again, we're looking for that metric, that measuring stick, that number that becomes more and more and more objective. And as we know, heart rate is limited in that way because if you got to go to the bathroom, it's going to be 5 beats too high.
A little dehydrated, it's going to be hot. Yeah.
Sleep. There's so many things that can influence heart rate.
The 4 shots of espresso I've had this morning.
It's going to influence heart rate. The none that I've had. This question is influencing my heart rate. But I think when it comes to all of these things, we keep looking for this gold standard and you see it talked about in the literature and you see it talked about amongst scientists. We're not going to find the gold standard because there isn't anything purely physical that defines the ability of an athlete. And we have to, when we enter into training and we enter into evaluation, there has to be this blending of the soft science and the hard science because neither of them explain it well on their own.
So I want to share a story here that I think really exemplifies what you're talking about, this using pace. So I think I've mentioned to you before, my nephew last year, he's 24, decided he was going to go and run a marathon, which he had never done before. He was kind of more a strength athlete and wanted to try this endurance side. Mm-hmm. I offered to help him. He's like, no, I've got it all taken care of. So he read some stuff on this. And by the way, the conclusion of the story was me saying to him, next time, let me coach
you. I was expecting I told you so, but no, close enough.
Close enough. And so he read all this stuff and he read all the stuff about pace.
Yep.
And just like you were saying, he just went out every day and ran marathon pace. And all he did building up to the marathon was just increasing the distance he could run at marathon pace. And one of the questions I asked him later is, you've never run a marathon. How do you know your marathon pace? I'm like, what was your heart rate during those rides? He's like, well, I don't know. I didn't have a heart rate monitor. He never once looked at his heart rate. So he ran at what he thought was his marathon pace, which was much more the, here's what I would like to run my marathon at. Here's the time I'd like to do. Here's the pace for that. So that's what I'm going to run at all the time. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a 30-minute run or a 2-hour run, I'm just going to run at that pace. Long as he ever did leading up to the marathon was about 25 kilometers, 30 kilometers, did fairly long. Goes to the marathon. He did a marathon in Scotland. And 2 kilometers from the finish, he literally just passed out. Hit the ground. They revived him. He threw up all over the paramedics who were taking care of him. And then slowly walked the remaining 2 kilometers.
But he finished.
He did finish. Okay, hey, full good credit for that.
Oh my gosh.
Wow, he is a Connor through and through. But
yeah. The preparation was not right. And when I was talking to him, I'm like, did you ever do intervals or intensity? Nope.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, he just needed to run a marathon before he ran the marathon. Then he would have been okay, right?
There you go. He had no idea pacing. So it goes back to what you were saying. If he had had heart rate and we had figured out what are your zones, it could have been good old, you know, do most of your time in that zone 1, zone 2. We know generally where marathon runners, you know, what heart rate zone they do a marathon in. So we could do a little bit of running at that pace to get him comfortable with it, do some interval work. And I think he would have been far, far more prepared, but he got obsessed with pace.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's missed is, you know, we're really lucky in Boulder because a lot of runners come here to train and you can watch these really elite marathoners out there doing a 10-minute mile shuffle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet nobody really leans into that. It is time on your feet. Yeah. It's adding muscular and bone stress, which is good. And time on your feet for runners is good. It's it's probably a good thing. But when you're running at that super high pace, you're going to beat yourself up. And I think what we need to be using heart rate for with runners is a cap. I want you below this when you're running at zone 1 or zone 2. And isn't it going to be perfect? No, it's not going to be perfect. But an honest measuring stick of, okay, heart rate's one of the things I can use here. So is RPE. And so is a clear understanding of stride, cadence, some of these other factors that are going to limit the ability for people to go super, super hard when they're supposed to be going fairly easy. And good coaching requires all of this stuff. I am very sure that we are going to start seeing and I've said this before and I'm waiting for it to happen. We are going to start seeing the lawsuits coming out of athletics from athletes towards coaches for abuse in things that could be perceived simply as training. Not sexual abuse, not mental abuse, but you abused me as a person and my body because this is what you prescribed. You were the expert. I followed through on the expert and I am now broken because of what you prescribed. And it's going to get abused, but it should be happening because what some of the coaches are doing in swimming and running, and you see it in cycling too, it's abusive. And to finish out this point, what you're saying, Trevor, about what your nephew did.
Yep.
We see it in cyclists all the time. They go out and they see how long they can hold threshold or how long they can hold tempo. And I'm going to another 10 minutes at threshold just to see if I can get ready for this 40K time trial. Yeah,
I have an hour today, so I'm going to ride as hard as I can for an hour. And I have 3 hours tomorrow, so I'll ride as hard as I can for 3 hours.
Right. But it comes back to this whole thing of like, it is kind of pseudo-logical, right? If I can hold this pace for longer, then I'm going to be able to hold this pace for longer. But that's where the understanding, and this comes all the way back to Griffin's first question. This is comes back to the understanding of why you hire a coach, that objectivity mm-hmm. and that knowledge.
I love how my question boomeranged and morphed all the way back to Griffin's question.
That's because
that was an interesting journey.
Your question was just fantastic.
Was it?
Yeah.
Truth.
As was Griffin's.
Truth.
It's very true.
Burr, winter. The air is cold. But you're getting back to conditioning and looking to rev up your training. If you haven't already, now is a great time of year to reflect on the past season. Specifically, when it comes to data and recovery, two very important metrics in endurance sports. Visit Fast Talk Labs and take a look at our pathways on recovery and data analysis. These two in-depth guides can help you get the most from your off-season. See more at fasttalklabs.com/pathways. Grant has a question for us.
Yeah, I almost feel like we got to stop recording for a second so I can calm the you-know-what down.
Can I just point out, no question here today? It would just be too much truth.
That's fine. You're questionable.
I'm kind of like forgetting I remember my question. Okay.
Do you want me to read it for you?
No, I got it. I got it. So my question comes back to a training and coaching question, and it's kind of pushed out to you guys. And it was brought up. For me, I was at Cyclocross Worlds this weekend, and it was an incredibly heavy course. And it's really funny. You've watched Tabor on TV a million times. You get there and you ride. I rode more laps than I can count of this course in coaching. It is the second hardest cyclocross course I've ever seen in my life.
What was the hardest?
Valkenburg at Worlds.
Valkenburg. That was an absurd Worlds year too.
Yeah. I mean, Tabor in the dry is hard because there's elevation and it's difficult. Tabor in the frozen is hard because there's elevation and it's really, really fast. Tabor wet and heavy, it's next level. It's so, so difficult. We walked out of this race with a couple of my athletes going, okay, this is something we need to work on if we want to be successful in Europe. That low cadence, mashing the pedals, being able to handle that structurally, being able to put out power in that place. That's cross in Europe. No matter what we've changed about the bike, you still have to be able to do this. So my question is, when you're training an athlete or preparing an athlete, do you become that singular in the focus that you're training an athlete purely for one event, purely for one thing, one day, one focus, or do we spend our time broadening the athlete across all the spectrums? So to put this in a technical piece of using Neil's 4DP, do we train one aspect of 4DP that is going to be relevant for the race we're going to? Or do we try to bring all the pieces of 4DP up so that we're a more well-rounded athlete and can be successful in lots of different conditions?
You already know my opinion on this one.
It depends.
No.
That's mine.
I know.
That's yours. That is yours. First of all, my opinion is broken into two parts. First.
Well, then you have two opinions.
No, two parts of the same opinion.
Sorry, I'm just being
a pre-opinion and there's
just being a jerk. Sorry.
You haven't gotten off of that soapbox yet, have you?
No, I'm fired up, man.
So stay there. Well, so here's my first part. I always think there's a big danger in being solely focused on one event because of how much can go wrong. And I've seen that so often. I can't tell you how often I've seen athletes really focus on one event. That event goes poorly or horribly sometimes. and then you just send them to another race that they haven't been thinking about the next weekend. They win that race. Yep. And that's what they remember from the season. So yep. There's just a huge danger in being that solely focused on a single event. And I even remember a friend who went to the Olympics who got crashed out in the final lap. Her only take home from going to the Olympics was, I will never focus exclusively on an event, even the Olympics, like that again. So that's my first. My second is, sorry, I know some of our listeners don't like it when I use car analogies, but they just work. Whatever the event is, I would rather have a Ferrari than a Honda Civic that's really customized to the event.
All right. I love a Civic.
Is that true?
I love me a Civic.
If you have an off-road,
well, you're the car racer.
If you have an off-road rally cross sort of thing, I'd take suspension over engine.
Okay, I wasn't quite going there, but I'm talking about on the road. Let's say
I was more thinking about the hatchback space in a Civic.
Mm.
Yeah,
you get your bike in it.
Ooh, nice. I like that. You know, Grant, it's a tough question that I think can be answered many different ways. I think that the majority of training that you do, the long term, the big picture stuff, has to be tailored to the needs of the sport and the event in general, right? Like if we're talking about like a crit racer versus a Grand Tour contender, right? Probably train those people in two very different ways.
Yep.
And I think that we understand what the needs are for cyclocross, right? And so I think that the majority of training ought to be focused on the needs of cyclocross in a situation like this. But I do think that we do have to be specializing a little bit. But I think that that comes much, much later in training. For this reason alone, you can make an assumption, Tabor in February, probably frozen or muddy, probably, but you don't know that for sure. What happens if it's 75 and sunny?
Mm-hmm.
And you did literally all of your training to be good at 50 RPM grinding, then you probably missed the mark because you made a guess. Now, as you get close, more than anything for me, it's if the person is well-trained physiologically, then really what you need to be focusing on is training them psychologically. The specific work that I would be doing prior to that race is to get them comfortable in those conditions, not to rewrite their physiology to be optimal in those conditions. How do they feel confident, right? You talked about athletes having crashes and then it just lap times just being destroyed after that, right? Because it gets in your head.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get somebody comfortable in frozen, muddy conditions? How do you mimic that tension you feel in your legs on that heavy course? And cyclocross racers are probably dealing with this throughout the season at various times, but we want them confident in that. I don't necessarily need to change the length tension relationship of their muscle. I need them to go in knowing they can perform well. And I think that you can do that relatively quickly, relatively close to the event.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you have an event that's one of your target events, doing a little customization leading up to the event, there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm always hesitant to put the whole season on a single event.
Yeah.
And do everything around that one event.
And I think the other thing too, right, is, you know, let's say you have a road national championship, you know what the course is going to be, weather is not going to, it's not going to be like it's a heavy condition. And let's say there's a 1 minute climb that you really think is going to be really decisive. Can you do a little extra training to be good there? I certainly think that you can, but you also still need to focus on things like FTP to make sure the athlete is getting to the 1 minute climb with the group. Somebody like myself, my FTP is so bad, but my 1 minute is so good. I would be flying up it for 30th place, you know? So the general fitness does matter.
So am I hearing you essentially say core now, customize later?
Yeah. And you know, one of the things I was going to kind of add on to this question is bigger picture, like looking at, you brought up a crit racer versus the tour, right? When we bring somebody into a sport, we also have a tendency to look at that person and try to project and guess at what they're going to be good at. They tend to be slim or they tend to be small. And when we get into cycling, we're like, oh, they're going to be a climber. Or they tend to be bigger and stronger and we look at them and go, oh, they're going to be a flatlander or a roller or whatever, right? And I think there's danger in that too, because I have many an athlete that, and this is a little bit to what you're asking, Griffin, is if I were to look at this athlete at 18 or 19 and decide they were going to be a climber and put all of this effort into them being a climber, climbing is very psychological and how you do it. It's a very specific set of skills and how you do it. And it's not just weight to strength to weight ratio, right? So I do think at the beginning, what we have to be trying to produce is very well-rounded athletes. And as we get closer to an opportunity, as that athlete hits 21, 22 or something, and they're starting to close in on a discipline, maybe that we sharpen the sword toward that discipline or toward an event. I couldn't agree more with you, Trevor, as I think it's a terrifying idea to put everything into one, all the eggs in one basket, because there is just so much that can go wrong. And then what it does to you psychologically, oh my gosh, most people can't handle that. And it takes a lot of practice to be able to handle that. So yes, I think part of what you're saying, Griffin, is 100% true. Like I would start very broad with the brush and then try to get closer and closer to this fine line of what we're trying to do.
I'll even take this a step further and say, even if you're focused on that one event and it's really key, I have seen cases where athletes get so focused on that event, they don't build skills that actually are crucial or assets that are crucial to that event because they're so focused on one particular aspect of that, that event. So let me give you a couple examples. And I might be remembering this wrong, but as I remember the first Tour de France that Pogacar won, there was a cobblestone stage in that. And all the contenders were worried about the mountains, worried about the time trials. He was the only one that built those cobblestone skills. I remember it ended up splitting up. He ended up in the lead group, and a lot of his contenders lost the tour that day because they weren't focused on that. Give you another example. My nephew was a really good climber. The first time he went to Canadian Nationals.
Same marathon nephew?
Different nephew. My oldest nephew.
I got a lot of freaking nephews.
I got seven. He was a really good climber. And there was a big climb at Nationals. And so he was completely focused on that. And, you know, it was all about, I'm going to get to the climb and I'm going to drop everybody. We finally saw the course map a week before Nationals. And there was this out and back where you just go out this flat, straight road. There's a cone. You do a 180 around the cone. And I'm trying to tell him, Cam, be wary of that. Be ready for that. You need to be at the front of the group. But all he was focused on was the climb because he was going to win the race on the climb. He got to the cone. He was about 70th wheel. The guys who knew what these cones are like were at the front. They came around. They pinned it. They absolutely shattered the field. And by the time he got to the climb, he was in the third group.
Yeah. Right.
Race was over.
Well, you know, one of the things that I look at with this too is this also in terms of training and training plan development, this singular focus on one aspect of the training can make us very myopic and miss a lot of the other pieces, right? And even miss some of the research that comes through this. Now, Trevor, you mentioned it a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about, should we focus on one type of training or many types of training? And you're like, but we do know that even when we're focusing on one type of training, we're focusing on lots of different types of training all at the same time. Or it's more the other way around. But I tend to look at things and sit there and say, I am a strong believer. If we can raise the high end, we raise everything up. We create room for everything to come up. If we're singularly focused on time trial and all we're thinking about is our threshold, 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 FTP, 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 we're missing out on some other factors for sure. I think what we're then missing is that there, you know, if we get focused purely on time trial, right? Purely on FTP, purely on LT, then we're spending all our time there. We're forgetting that if we push the high end, we're going to be able to raise the availability there of some of those things. So getting super focused on one aspect, like you said, focus on the sprint, you don't get to the line. Focus on the climb, maybe you don't get to the climb. There's so much more in preparing for across the board with some sharpening on one piece of the puzzle.
So I remember reading this book on building your cycling skills in the field. So it wasn't anything on training. It was all, how do you pace line? How do you strategize? How do you ride in a peloton? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of the book, but they had this great story at the beginning of these two older, meaning our age, riders who jumped into this fairly big US pro race. And all the pros there being shocked that these guys who were not as strong as them were there the whole time and stayed at the front and they couldn't get rid of them. And the point they made in this book was, these guys had built so many skills. They knew so well how to ride in a field. They could compensate for lack of strengths by that experience, by that knowledge, that they could stay at the front. And so that to me is that generalist, build all the assets, build all the skills. You'd be amazed what you can compensate for and make sure that you're in position to win.
And I will say I'm constantly blown away in road racing of how little skill set is placed in the forefront of what we're trying to do for these athletes. I'm blown away at how little these athletes watch cycling and like watch where these people are in the last 5K coming into the line if they're coming into a sprint. How little they watch European small road classic type cycling before they go over there and try to participate in this. And, you know, I've gone through this with many athletes of like, yeah, these are general skills, but how we apply those general skills specifically to an event becomes really one of the ways we can be successful.
And Grant, I want to clarify something because I think that you're right, but I also think that it's a watch with the intent to learn.
Right.
And
yeah,
not,
absolutely.
And not just watch to be entertained, not sure. Watch at a superficial level.
Yeah.
But to observe and to understand and to dissect and to make better decisions because of it is a skill that a lot of people don't have. And I even see it with athletes pre-riding a course. Mm-hmm. They're just out there mindlessly hot lapping. They're not testing. They're not observing what other people are doing. They're not feeling the ground under their tires and trying to learn. They're just trying to remember what turn comes next.
Well, and hence, this is one of the things that we run into it at Worlds is I think athletes spend way too much time on the course. Mm-hmm. I think they should spend one really specific day on the course, learn the specifics of it, learn whether you need the turn, and then understand the conditions are going to be totally different in a day or two days later.
Especially at a green course like cyclocross. Yeah.
Right. You can't expect to know what the answer is going to be in 2 days. Mm-hmm. Coming back tomorrow is not going to help you do that.
Yep.
And athletes spend way too much time at the course, at the venue, doing those things. And it's emotional energy suck that's next level.
So let me give a different analogy here to your question that I think is better than my car analogy. Which is better? If you have a job to do, showing up with a really robust toolbox where you've got every tool imaginable, or showing up with a toolbox that's somewhat limited but has one amazing tool that you know is the tool you're primarily going to need for the job, which is better?
You need the one with all the tools because you never know what you're going to run into. You might not get a chance to use it.
Though.
Can't do what?
You can't show up with a 1,000-pound toolbox.
Truth.
I mean, and this is the other side of it too, is that
that's fair.
We have to make decisions with training. We literally cannot train everything. And oftentimes training our sprint is detrimental to training FTP at the opposite end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I do think we got to pick and choose.
I think you know what that is?
Awesomeness, the truth.
That's the truth.
It's knowing your athlete, right? Like that goes back to the beginning. It's knowing your athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. And knowing yourself, right? And then coming down to that relationship between the athlete and the coach, that the athlete can say, I need to be able to do this better. And the coach going, well, yeah, you do, but you also need to do these other four things really well too. And we can't, you know, not see the forest for the trees.
That's knowing the truth.
Right there. This has been another episode of Fast Talk. The opinions expressed on this show are not those of Fast Talk, but instead of the individual hosts. For more information, look at our social media sites. And we'll talk to you next time. Peace.
Outro I've ever heard in my life.
We'll leave it at the vague social media. Yeah. So.
Oh, by the way, this is the end of the episode.
We're out. Peace.
For all of us,
I'm Grant Holicky.
Thanks for listening.